From South Carolina Public Radio, this is the South Carolina Lead. I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode was recorded on September 23rd, 2024, from South Carolina Public Radio Studios here in Columbia. On this episode of The Lead, we preview the week ahead.
Awesome.
Senator Lindsey Graham weighs in on the Republican gubernatorial drama north of the border.
Mm-hmm.
A Democratic statehouse lawmaker resigns amid his own controversy.
Mm-hmm.
And we hear about folks who are moving to states based on their politics.
Mm-hmm.
Also, USC law professor Derek Black analyzes the state Supreme Court's decision striking down the latest school voucher program. The Lead loves hearing from y'all. You can use our voicemail voucher system at 803-563-7169. There are no public funds being used for this. You can just call for free, and you might end up on the pod. Give us a hot take. Give us something to talk about. We'd love to hear from you. 803-563-7169. Let's kick off the pod by looking at what's on tap this week. Up at the United Nations, it's UNGA week. The United Nations General Assembly, or UNGA to cool Politico people, convenes with some 140 world leaders descending on Manhattan. President Joe Biden will be addressing the General Assembly on Tuesday. Governor Henry McMaster will attend the 64th annual meeting of the Southern States Energy Board in Chattanooga. That actually happened on Monday, so the governor was in Tennessee on Monday. Congress is in this week, and the House is expected to vote on a stopgap funding bill that will keep the government funded through December 20th. We can do all this all over again right before Christmas. Semaphore reports that the short-term spending bill will have additional funding for the U.S. Secret Service while excluding the twice-rejected election integrity proposal Speaker Mike Johnson had previously insisted on attaching to the measure. And on the campaign trail, the vice presidential debate is a week away on October 1st, and both Kamala Harris and Donald Trump are crisscrossing the country along with their running mates. We're getting close, folks. Now, if it's Sunday, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham is on a show repping the Trump campaign. This week, he joined moderator Kristen Welker on NBC's Meet the Press, where he spoke on a range of issues, including potential ramifications from North Carolina Republican gubernatorial candidate Mark Robinson's alleged past comments on a pornographic website, and again, pleading for Trump to stick to the issues.
I think what's going to happen here is that he deserves a chance to defend himself, Mark Robinson. The charges are beyond unnerving. If they're true, he's unfit to serve for office. If they're not true, he has the best lawsuit in the history of the country for libel. He's claiming they were artificially created and that CNN passed it along to be true. Has NBC confirmed this?
Not yet. We're all looking into it.
Well, so what I would do if I were him, I would hire me the best lawyer I could find. I'd sue the hell out of CNN because what they're saying about him is just unbelievable. Now, he needs to do more. In my view, he has a right to defend himself. He has an obligation to defend himself. This is hanging over his campaign. Trump won in 2016 and 2020 when the governor candidate lost both times. I don't think this hurts Trump. But as to Robinson, he's a political zombie if he does not offer a defense to this that's credible.
Senator, these allegations, this story came out on Friday. He has had multiple days to defend himself. He has not produced one shred of evidence. And as you know, he's had plenty of other highly controversial comments in the past, including saying, let's stop talking about Hitler and the Nazis. Do you think he could cost Trump North Carolina?
No, I really don't, because Trump won when the governor candidate lost in 2016 and 2020. But here's what's important. I'm in South Carolina. I see the ads every 15 seconds. This is a major allegation by a major news organization that needs to be addressed. He has not only a right to defend himself, but an obligation to defend himself.
At the very least, should former President Trump pull his endorsement or make it clear that he's distancing himself?
I think what you're going to see happen here is Robinson's going to have to deal with it. There's nothing no accusation involving Trump. It's all about Robinson. You asked a good question. Should every Republican in the country be held responsible for this guy? I would say no. It's him, not me. It's not Trump. He's the one that supposedly said these things. He has a right to defend himself. He needs to defend himself.
All right, let's talk about another headline this week. Donald Trump was speaking at an Israeli-American Council event. He did make waves because he seemed to suggest that Jewish voters would be to blame if he doesn't win the election, Senator. The second gentleman, Doug Emhoff, said those comments were trafficking in tropes, scapegoating Jews. Is he right? How do you respond?
I would tell President Trump that the Jewish American voters probably can concerned about the same thing that all other voters are to the Democratic Party. Why are you losing African-American men? Why are you losing ground with minorities? Rather than blaming them, you ought to convince them to vote for Vice President Harris. My advice to President Trump is that the Jewish American voter, I'm sure they do care about Israel. There's been no better friend of Israel. But talk about crime, talk about the economy, talk about inflation, talk about border. That's the way you persuade people in this country. We have an obligation to persuade people to vote for us.
While Graham doesn't see this controversy as affecting Trump in North Carolina, many other folks do, as well as other races on the ballot. Robinson's campaign manager and a slew of other folks have resigned from his campaign. Sticking with our congressional delegation, 6th District Democratic Congressman Jim Clyburn announced hundreds of millions in federal funding for South Carolina to boost domestic production of advanced batteries and battery materials. Companies in the 6th Congressional District will receive at least $350 million of the total $848 million investment. That's the largest investment in any state in the nation as part of the Department of Energy's Battery Materials Processing and Battery Manufacturing and Recycling Program. Per DOE, these projects are integral to the clean energy industrial strategy to bolster a domestic supply chain that enhances America's energy security and economic competitiveness. Batteries. Now, these projects are part of over $3 billion in investments for 25 selected projects across 14 states to, like we said, boost domestic production of advanced batteries and battery materials. These grants were funded through the bipartisan infrastructure law, which Congressman Jim Clyburn was the sole House member in the South Carolina delegation to support it, as well as Senator Lindsey Graham. Some state House news. Last Monday, North Charleston Democratic Representative Marvin Pendarvis resigned from his District 113 seat amid an ongoing lawsuit from a former legal client and investigation into its allegations, this according to the South Carolina Daily Gazette. His departure from the state House comes 5 months after a former client sued him, claiming Pendarvis settled his lawsuit without his knowledge, forged his signature for the $10,000 settlement, and then tried to buy him off to prevent the allegations from becoming public. The day after Adrian Lewis filed his complaint in April, the state law enforcement division confirmed an investigation into Pendarvis. In May, the state Supreme Court suspended his law license. And again, this is from the South Carolina Daily Gazette. Now, the state of South Carolina on Friday successfully executed its first death row inmate in more than 13 years. Murderer Freddie Owens died by lethal injection at Broad River Correctional Institution after appeals to the U.S. Supreme Court and to Governor Henry McMaster for clemency were denied. The execution took 19 minutes. Moving on, earlier this month, the South Carolina Supreme Court ruled 3-2 that part of the school voucher program passed by lawmakers and signed into law by the governor as a pilot program violated the state's constitutional ban on using public money in education scholarship trust funds for private school tuition and fees. But money can still be used for indirect expenses like books, tutoring, and technology. I spoke with University of South Carolina law professor Derek Black about this decision. Black is an expert on educational policy and constitutional law, and he's an author as well. His book, Schoolhouse Burning, is a must-read if you want to understand public education. Here was part of our conversation.
You know, last time the state just wrote the check directly out of the treasury to the private schools. This time they said, well, let's put it in another state account before we send it there, and we'll call that account a trust. You know, Gary Hill also got into the point of like, this doesn't operate like any trust that he at least had seen before. And so you were putting a name on a thing, but at the end of the day, it was a state account, and those funds were going to go directly from, they weren't going to somehow go to parents in between. They weren't going to stop somewhere for parents. Parents weren't going to be able to do whatever they wanted. Parents weren't going to be able to choose any school in the state. It was going to go into a state account and still have a lot of state management and decisions about who could get access to that money, when, where, and how. And Gary says, looks still like, you know, public money going directly to private schools.
And when we talk about this money, it's a current pilot program that allowed up to 3,000 students to receive $1,500 each.
with plans to expand the vouchers up to $6,000 a year for 5,000 students, then eventually 15,000 students. So we're talking about $90 million annually that would have been moving around here. That's not the case now for at least tuition and fees. So do you think that this program will still survive in some shape or form when it comes to funding things like books, like tutoring?
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of private school parents out there that could use help with tutoring or school books. And, you know, there's no problem with that. The Constitution doesn't prohibit that. So I don't think it's going to, the money is not all going to be spent. I think it's going to be hard for probably for most parents to spend that much money on sort of things around the edges.
So, Tarek, when you look at other states across the country, obviously there's school vouchers. I think programs push at least 16 states right now. How do we rank, I would say, like when it comes to, does every other state have a constitutional decision like this, a constitutional on the books where it's saying that you cannot use this directly versus maybe something that's different in another state where it's a little bit looser, that's how they get around these laws?
Yeah, so there are about half of the states that have what we call no aid provisions. And mm-hmm. some of them simply say no aid to private schools, private religious schools. The Supreme Court declared that type of language unconstitutional 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. So all these, a number of states, I don't know if it's 15 or 20, but a number of them, those provisions are unconstitutional. South Carolina falls in another subset, which says, we don't care whether you're religious or non-religious. We don't want public dollars going to public funds. So the United States Supreme Court said, that's fine, right? And so there are, a handful of states in that position. And people have tended to be successful in challenging these programs. A year ago, the Kentucky Supreme Court struck down a voucher program there. Right, 5 or so years ago, Nevada struck down one there. Every state is different, has a different history, but, you know, South Carolina, I guess, has the sort of prototypical public funds for public schools type of constitutional provision. So in that respect, it's not entirely surprising that our Supreme Court came out this way. Mm-hmm. And that history is long. I mean, yeah. I think that's an important thing. You know, we get so caught up in what we want today and, you know, sort of changing times, but there was a commitment in 1868 in this state that said, we got to get this public school system off the ground. We believe this is crucial to the future of citizenship, both for formerly enslaved people mm-hmm. and middle class and working class white folks that didn't have public schools. And they said, we can't spare a dime for anything else. And we also don't want people coming and lobbying us for this money, right? Like the railroads used to do, right? Mm-hmm. And so let's just make it simple. Let's make a commitment. And public education is a singular constitutional obligation of the state. They don't have any choice but to have public schools. And so in mandating that choice, they're also excluding another choice. And of course, there's a lot of Jim Crow and other things that went under the bridge since then. But that sort of idea that money ought to be reserved exclusively for public schools is one that's about, 170 or so years old at this point.
I'm going to ask you about your book, Schoolhouse Burning, Public Education, The Assault on American Democracy. We last talked about that in 2020, and there was a really important passage in there that I talked to you about then, I want to talk to you about now. And it said, far too many people are not equipped with the education they need to distinguish fact from fiction, good policy from bad, or even their own self-interest. A large chunk of society has lost faith in government's capacity to do anything good, so it lashes out against government. Those who know better are exploiting these knowledge and perception gaps and clamoring for restrictions on voting and public education. If education becomes a bystander in a political power struggle, democracy could lose a tool it needs to heal itself. Do you think that education is maybe not so much even a bystander now, but almost a victim of modern politics?
It sounds like you're telling the story of my next book. I mean, I think that for
those... Spoiler.
Well, you know, there was this sort of hopefulness in my last book that... And I think a lot of bipartisan support and advocacy groups thought that maybe public education can help us get out of this divisive moment. Maybe it can heal our democracy. And I think actually a lecture I just gave day before yesterday in Pennsylvania on Constitution Day said, look, education has now become unfortunately intertwined with the unraveling of certain parts of our democracy. Mm. And that's unfortunate. It used to be something that we could all agree upon, and now we seem to be at each other's throats.
You can watch that full interview on youtube.com/South Carolina ETV. And South Carolina Public Radio's Victoria Hansen has this report on folks who are self-segregating to Republican and democratically controlled states based on legislation and their personal beliefs. Take a listen.
Colorful gay pride and transgender flags flew in front of Mike Merrill's Charleston home for Pride Month in June. Typically, they'd hang out back, but the Merrill family grew tired of living in fear. So this summer, they moved out of state.
Scary. And with the political climate and with the election that's going on and all this stuff. It's scary. I just want to get onto the other side of a blue state where I feel safe.
That blue state they fled to is Illinois. Merrill and his husband Greg Cantor say they knew last year they'd have to leave when their transgender daughter, Emily, could no longer get hormone treatments at the Medical University of South Carolina. Then the Republican-led state legislature threatened funding. Now it's enacted a ban on all gender-affirming health care for minors, despite doctors' objections.
Yeah, we saw the writing on the wall. I mean, the politicians didn't care about the facts. They just used it as a political wedge issue.
Caught in the middle, Cantor says, were his children and his congregation. The well-known rabbi resigned from an historic Charleston synagogue. His 16-year-old daughters, Elena and Emily, packed up their bedrooms. They've lived in Charleston half their lives.
This is all Elena, by the way.
Yeah, I have to pack my room still, and it's, like, kind of messy in here.
Elena was eager to leave what she calls fear-fueled laws.
We're not doing anything to hurt you. We're just trying to live our own lives and, like, be ourselves and, like, live in peace.
Emily hoped life as a transgender teenager would be better in Illinois, where LGBTQ rights are protected.
Oh, yeah. Definitely just being myself. I might find someone who's maybe just like me, but I don't know if I will. But if I do, it's going to be amazing.
The Cantor-Merrill family isn't alone in their desire to move because of politics. Paul Chabot founded a real estate company called Conservative Move after taking his family from California to Texas. For nearly a decade, he says, he's found a growing market of people looking to leave heavily Democratic blue states like he did.
And I jokingly say they're looking to move to America when they're in America. And that's largely these red states when we're looking at freedom and cost of living.
He says South Carolina has quickly become a popular destination because it's affordable and increasingly conservative. That's why retired orthodontist John West and his wife Betty moved to Pawleys Island from Georgia last November.
We saw our state going very blue. I'm sorry to, you know, whoever gets to hear this, but, you know, you're either on one side of the fence or you're on the other.
West says they were fed up with crime in their Atlanta suburb. Wife Betty says they're Christian and concerned about immigration. They're also pro-life, support school choice, and gun rights laws.
I agree with everything that they say here.
Betty says here they can be themselves. That wasn't the case in Georgia.
No, we would never wear a MAGA hat or a Trump t-shirt. We couldn't even put our Trump signs out on the street.
We caught up with the West as they attended an event for a Trump-backed congressman. Political scientist Mark Owens wanted to know what South Carolina's newcomers and natives care about most. He helped the Citadel conduct a poll earlier this year.
One of the questions we ask, which is, how do you feel about the other party? And people who moved here just 5 years ago, 62% think that the Democratic Party is a threat to them in some way.
Owen says any political impact is hard to predict. And yes, more people are moving to the Palmetto State at a rapid rate. But he says people self-segregating nationwide based on politics could make it more difficult to,
you know, challenge our own points of view because there might be a feedback loop coming back to what we feel most comfortable with.
In other words, isolation may further deepen an already profound political divide.
You can find that and all of our wonderful coverage on SouthCarolinaPublicRadio.org. And while you're there, hit that donate button, folks. It's pledge season. Welcome to the wind down section, our little break from the news. We're glad you're here. AT Shire lead producer is here too. And AT, we will be on the radio.
That's right.
Working through our FM radio drive time banter
Yes.
on September 25th from 5 to 6.
Yes.
And October 1st from 5 to 6 for pledge drive. So be sure to listen and to donate and to just, you know, actually hear our banter live, real time, and
unrehearsed.
See how we do. Unrehearsed. They say, here's a topic, and we say, here's a topic.
It's
that's what we say back and
we
forth.
We have the perfect quid pro quo. Oh. We have the perfect repartee. We're going to be giving away a Golden John Tesh record.
Can you believe that?
I bet you could, honestly. I'm gonna say I bet you could believe it.
What was the guitar we gave away? Joe Bonamassa
signed. I wanted to cross out his name and sign my own name, but I heard that would devalue.
It. I don't know, Mike. Mike Boosted.
Mike Boosted. Big South of Spooky fans. Anyway, Gavin, we have a call with I would say, a request on it to speak about something that I never would have seen coming.
Okay.
So, are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay, set here it we up. Go.
Hi, this is Harrison Howell calling in from beautiful Aiken, South Carolina. I don't want to get too controversial for the wind down, but I just wanted to ask you guys your opinion on raw milk and whether or not, you know, it's the best idea to drink. I've had a lot of interesting discussions as of late with some friends, and just wanted to know what you guys think. Great podcast. Keep it up. Bye.
Harrison, thank you for the call. I love that you preface this by saying, I don't want to get too controversial for the wind down.
No such thing.
That is perfectly okay.
Yeah, this is great.
And this, I don't feel, is too controversial, all things considered, in our modern political environments. But, you know, when it comes to the raw milk, I know a lot of people are pro. I hear a lot of people talking about it. Mm-hmm. I don't quite understand it. I don't really drink milk, dairy products. I eat Greek yogurt, and that's about the extent of my dairy journey.
That's what that's sort of the angle I'm taking on this, Harrison Howell.
Tell them.
I love the double H,
Disclaim?
I must disclose, yes, I am lactose intolerant, raw or otherwise.
Tell them first.
I'm not, if you're an adult drinking milk, okay, I'm going to say don't do that anymore. You don't need to do it, you know? And yeah. I don't think Louis Pasteur is someone to be completely disregarded. I don't know, you know.
Weren't they saying that you have a greater chance of maybe being affected by a raw oyster than raw milk? And it's always difficult to say, well, maybe you might get E. coli or salmonella or something else.
You're taking a chance every single time.
There was a little disclaimer on the menu when it's, you know, eating raw, blah, blah, blah.
Raw egg, raw beef,
but
something like that.
I don't know. I've never really seen the difference. I guess I've never actually had raw milk, so I cannot really tell you authentically the difference. But I do like when you go to a dairy and you get that good whole milk or that whole chocolate milk in the glass bottle.
Fully pasteurized, though.
Yeah, it's still
fully
pasteurized. But like, okay, what are we getting out of this?
I want to know why so many people have like a lifestyle based around drinking milk as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
That is a little strange to me, more than something being raw or not raw. It's just sort of like, okay, don't make milk your personality.
But, well, then it's also, I think a lot of people are pushing it because it's like, everyone's resisting everything now, too.
Mm-hmm.
I think. Well, yeah. You know, you don't have to have pasteurized milk. It's like, sure, you probably don't, but overall, as a society and with medical and technological advancements, we're better for pasteurized milk.
We live in a society.
Pasteurized things.
So I think Leeds coming down on team pasteurized a little bit,
yeah.
But like not in a way that we're trying to shame anyone who's not.
Sure. If it works for you, go ahead and do it. I think it's like a lot of people that talk about the magic of apple cider vinegar, which, you know, has been shown really not to substantiate all the claims, but I still,
yeah.
You know, I'm like, I feel fancy when I drink some apple cider vinegar.
I am a believer in,
I think it helps with everything going on.
The placebo effect is real, okay?
Yeah.
So if you think you're doing something very healthy for yourself, there's a good chance that, like, you're going to see some positive aspects that you find. But also, like, if anyone's trying to sell you on the idea that you're going to drink this thing and it's going to solve
so
a multitude of your problems.
Correct.
And it's just milk, you know, like, I don't think so. That's
I'm
what
not
cereal.
Into that
it's
part,
it's
yeah.
just for cereal.
Yeah.
You know, as an adult, it's for cereal. If it's pasteurized or unpasteurized, whatever. And if you're just chugging milk all day, all the time, I got questions for you beyond if it's raw
but
or not.
At this point, though, I will also support. I'm actually excited for someone actually talking about actual dairy. Like actual milk versus the number of other new milks that have been developed in our lifetime.
The nut milks.
I can't.
You're talking nut milks?
The oat, the nut.
The almond. Soy milk.
The poor almond getting squeezed.
Yes.
Have you even thought about the almond getting squeezed?
Will we
like
think
that?
Of
all
the almonds, please? It's very strange.
And where does
to
the
me?
Milk come from? The oat.
I feel this way about, it's like Chicago
it's this
pizza.
Thing. It's this thing.
Let's not call it milk. Let's not call that milk, okay?
a milky substance.
It's a replacement. Milk substance. It's not milk.
Like Velveeta, you know? It's a cheese product.
It's a milk adjacent product, you know. We just have a labeling issue here. It's not milk. You cannot milk a nut, you know. And so,
get this guy out of here.
Yeah. So Harrison, I'm against adults drinking milk, you know.
Wow. That's because you have the whole.
Exactly. I just think we're too milk centric that we're even having this conversation. Okay. Like, all right. If you are through puberty, if your bones are as big as they're going to get, as strong as your teeth are going to get.
No, people start losing their bone density. I should say you should take some calcium.
Yeah.
Also, like I told you earlier, I think I really reached peak milk in, you know, from 0 to 18.
Gavin, he had a lot.
I had a whiteout. Like
he had a whiteout.
Said.
He had a whiteout. There's some years he doesn't remember how much milk he had.
And now adult milk is the espresso martini.
Yes, adult milk. He says espresso martini. I say the White Russian.
The White Russian. Yeah.
That's about the only things that I would.
I would tell you the other day. I had an ice cold cherry Coke at Drake's Duck Inn down on Main Street. My unchecked and his own
shout out
here. I had a beer, and then it also came with a Coke. I was like, I don't want this beer anymore. Give me some fountain cherry Coke.
That's milk Gavin this, talking. That's milk
I'm
Gavin
sorry,
talking.
It's coming out, guys. We got to wrap it up.
We got to wrap this up, okay? For legal reasons, pasteurize your milk.
For legal reasons, don't take any of our advice.
Final say, legal reasons, pasteurize. Okay? That's all. Okay, yeah. As the producer, I had to say that. Now, Gavin, as the host, you have to say the credits.
Thank you, Harrison, for giving us a shout. You guys can be like Harrison. Give us a shout, 803-563-7169. We'd love to hear from you guys. Give us your takes. That's what we're here for. And, of course, you can always show us your appreciation by leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts. And stay up to date with the latest news on SCETV.org and SouthCarolinaPublicRadio.org. And don't forget to support your local newspapers. The South Carolina Lead is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Amy Crouch is our supervising producer. Sean Birch is our executive producer. This podcast is produced with support from PRX and is made possible in part by a grant from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, as well as listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. For the South Carolina Lead, I'm Gavin Jackson. Be well, South Carolina.
Yeah, you got coin bags.
Oh, no, you got to turn it off and get the coin out.
Get the coin out. Got to turn it off, get the coin out.
Turn it off.
Yeah, 15th time this season that Scully's face down when the aliens go by. Mulder, he sees it.